One of the things that we wanted to do with this marching through the Bible in 2016 was to highlight major stories of the Bible. So we've already done Noah's Ark, and we've already done Joseph and the Egyptian captivity. We've already dealt with the crossing of the Red Sea. And finally, it seems like we've come to a point, we did the Ten Commandments 2 weeks ago. Finally, it seems like we should get to the point where the horses should come out of the gate, that we should get to the race, because the whole point now is going into the Promised Land. They've made it out of Egypt. The Egyptians are no longer chasing them. And now we should get to a point, they've been given the Ten Commandments, and that should organize the Israelites' life. And now we should be able to go into the Promised Land and move on with the story. But as anybody who is even remotely familiar with the Bible knows, that's not how it works. The bell doesn't go, the race, the starter's gun doesn't start, and they don't start running and everything goes well, but they fumble right out of the gate. The Israelites not only fumble right out of the gate, but they spend then the next 40 years wandering around in the wilderness, a generation. And Moses, their leader, who takes them to the very cusp of the Promised Land, he can see it. He can see where they're going at the end of the 40 years, but he dies before they ever make it into the Promised Land. He dies on the mountainside overlooking the entrance to the Promised Land. He never gets to see it and make it there himself. And so, this week we have this really weird story that we're all familiar with somewhat, but I bet you forgot this part. We all know the golden calf. If I say golden calf, you're familiar with that. You learned about it in Sunday school. It's in everybody's children's Bible. Golden calf's a good story. But this story is really, really weirder than we think, isn't it? Not only do the Israelites, they should be getting off on the right foot. They should start running the race. But the first thing they do when Moses goes away, the first thing they do when God and Moses and Joshua are up on the mountain together is not turn their attention to God who rescued them in the crossing of the Red Sea, but they get nervous. They even say to Aaron, "We can't handle it. We don't know what happened to Moses. It's taking too long. Are we there yet? Are we there yet? What's going to happen?" And so they build this golden calf to calm their anxiety down. They build this golden calf, perhaps an imitation of other gods that they worshipped back in Egypt, on the principle that, hey, if Moses is up there with that god, maybe we can build a god down here. Because if one god is good, two gods, therefore, is twice as good. And so this story, which should start with, and all the people in Israel paid attention to the Ten Commandments, and everything went well, and everybody lived happily ever after, doesn't happen that way at all. Moses, in a fury, throws down the commandments and breaks them into bits. Moses, in his anger, grinds up the golden calf, smushes it into powder, sprinkles it on water, and gives it to the Israelites to drink. Then Moses commands all the Levites to put on a sword and slay 3,000 of their friends and neighbors. This is a weird story. This is a really strange story. But it's here. And so we have to deal with it. We have to wrestle with it. When we look at it from our modern perspective, though, the really strange thing about idolatry, as I was thinking about idolatry this whole week, about the golden calf and what the problem with the golden calf was, the really strange thing is that the golden calf sort of functions as a blank screen. You can throw whatever it is up there, and you'll sin. And that's the way idolatry kind of works. And what I mean is this. The potential for idolatry is pretty much unique to any one of us. We're all familiar with workaholics who have turned their work into an idol. That's an example that we use all the time, that somebody goes into the office so that they can avoid being around their family. Somebody goes into the office because it's easier there. They know what their job is. They don't have to raise their kids pay as close attention. They've got teenagers at home, and you got to deal with all the problems of who gets the car and who doesn't get the car and all that kind of stuff. So somebody turns their work into an idol. and then ignores their family, ignores their friends, they ignore God. But it's just as likely for other people that the exact opposite, that laziness could be an idolatry. Did you ever think about that? That two things that are polar opposites could be idols? We might say that laziness is the opposite of hard work, but it can be an idol. It can be a golden calf. Oh, I'm just too lazy. I just can't get up. I expect somebody else to do it for me. Oh, I'm just too tired. I can't be bothered to get up and actually do something for myself. I just can't. I'm just too lazy to give any time and worship to God. After all, if God really wants me, He knows how to get a hold of me. So the golden calf functions, at least as far as I can tell, as this blank screen. And we can throw up whatever we want on this blank screen and turn that into an idol if we're not careful. And what may be an idol for me may not be an idol for you. So we got to watch. We've always got to be on our toes and pay attention to what it is that God might be calling us to stay away from. Idolatry is anything that keeps you from God. And it can be hard work. It can be laziness. It can be lust. It can be greed. We humans are like the old slogan from Burger King, have it your way, when it comes to idolatry. We can have it our way. And that's the interesting thing about idols, whether it's the golden calf or otherwise. The interesting thing to me is that you take the God of the whole universe. Now think about this for a minute. The Israelites have been in slavery for years and years and years, generations. They've been in slavery, then they are released through the 10 plagues. They've been protected all this time. All the plagues that happened to the Egyptians did not happen to the Israelites. The Israelites were protected by God. So all the darkness that covered the land, that didn't happen in Israelite lands. All the killing of the firstborn, that happened only in Egyptian territories. It didn't happen to the Israelites. Then they cross the Red Sea. God causes a pillar of fire and cloud to lead them to Mount Sinai. Moses goes up on the mountain. There's lightning, there's thunder, there's a cloud. There's all this excitement. And the God who's done all these things, the God of the whole universe, then becomes reduced down in the idolatry of the Egyptians to a golden calf. Now, somebody, and I don't know, they had too much time on their hands, somebody tried to figure out one time how much gold the golden calf probably would have been. This is really interesting to me. I don't really care, but it's an interesting footnote. In the Ten Commandments movie with Charlton Heston, the golden calf is huge, right? It's like a Volkswagen Beetle. It's very big. But somebody figured out that how much gold they probably would have had back then, these nomads running through the wilderness. And they determined that it probably would have been, I don't know, book size. It was not very big. And I think that's even more telling. Because you take this God who the whole universe cannot contain, this God who created the furthest star, and then you project all your wishes and all your hope on this little, rotten, small, tiny little thing that's so small, that's so weak, that's made with human hands. As a matter of fact, it's so small and weak, Aaron can even avoid responsibility a little bit. When Moses says, "What did you do?" He says, "I don't know, we just put gold into the fire and the calf popped out. I don't know how that happened, so I'm not really sure." But it's a sin. It's an idol to take our God and reduce Him to this little golden calf under our control. It's a sin and it's an idol to waste and disrespect the unimaginable, wide open love and power of God. In a world with so many needs, as we talked about with the children this morning, poverty and hunger, seniors who don't have enough food to eat in the richest country in the world, child soldiers in Africa, to use idols just to make me feel better, to prevent my anxiety, to make me feel better about waiting for Moses to come back down off of Mount Sinai is a sin. Is a sin. And is a textbook example of idolatry. And that's why I think the people, the Israelites, create this idol deep down. It somehow makes them feel better about themselves. It somehow eases their anxiety. Moses has been gone for a long time. Now, if God is in our midst, we can feel better about ourselves. One of my favorite series of novels is by Pennsylvania author John Updike. He wrote four novels about Rabbit Angstrom, Harry Rabbit Angstrom. And it's probably, in my opinion, it's probably the greatest picture of what it was like to be a white male in 20th century Pennsylvania, in 20th century America. They're a little dated now because we're in the 21st century, and he wrote before cell phones and computers and all that kind of stuff. But of the last century, I don't think anybody got it as spot on as John Updike did. And Rabbit Angstrom is this guy who lived in a small town outside of Reading, Pennsylvania. This character of Rabbit Angstrom has the American dream. He was a high school player, a basketball player, and he was really good. He was a fantastic basketball player. He never left his hometown. He married his high school sweetheart. He's living close to his parents. He's making good money at the factory. He's doing all the things that in the 1960s would be seen as positive. And yet, in these four books, Angstrom has terrible anxiety about his future. He has terrible anxiety about his life, and he runs away from his family. He's afraid of raising his kids. There's no manual on how to raise your kids. And in the first book, Rabbit runs away from his wife, who has two young kids at home, because he's scared. And he goes and he finds girlfriends in other places, and he spends the rest of the novel trying to find ways to calm down his anxiety. And he leaves back at home all these broken relationships and all these terrible things that happen because they need him at home. They need him to be a responsible father and husband, son, nephew. But Rabbit has to leave to find himself. And that's why I think it's a good novel for the 20th century, because so many people, well, this isn't about you, this is about me, I've got to find myself. This isn't about your life, this is about me and actualizing myself. And that's idolatry. Rabbit Angstrom had everything. He had it in his lap. He had it in abundance. But he went outside to try and find out how he could relate to the world without anxiety. And you know what he finds out, of course? He finds out that the world is just as scary out there as it is back in here. Rabbit Angstrom is named Rabbit because of his ears, because of how he looked. He sort of looked like a rabbit, they said. But he also bears a resemblance, literary-wise, to Peter Rabbit. You remember that story. Peter Rabbit, mom says, don't go out into the garden because Farmer McGregor's out there. That's exactly what happens. He goes out and almost gets caught and gets made into supper. Same thing happens with Harry Angstrom in John Updike's books. And so it is. We try and find ways to calm down our anxiety. We create these idols, not intentionally. Nobody ever sits down and says, oh, you know what, today I'm going to indulge in a little bit of idol worship before I go to work. Oh boy, that would be great. But instead, so it is. That's what we do. We're proud. We're indifferent. We don't pay attention to brutality or judgmentalism. And the only antidote, my friends, the only antidote that this weird story tells us, the only antidote to idolatry is relationship. That we've got to trust God. That the Israelites should have trusted God. They should have waited on God. Their ability to make an idol, to make this golden calf, is they don't trust God anymore. As a matter of fact, they almost say it. They say, we don't know what happened to Moses, so we're concerned now. So they can't trust. So that's the first relationship sin. But the second relationship that they should have done is they should have turned to each other. I mean, think, if somebody just stood up and said, hey, wait a minute, maybe we should wait. Hey, wait a minute, this is exactly what God doesn't want us to do. Somebody had just stood up and said, hey, wait a minute, Aaron, let's give it some more time. Let's throw a spoke in the wheel. Let's slow down a little bit here. If somebody had just said, I trust God, and I also trust us to be patient enough, it would be good for the Israelites. And this is what they learn. This is what they learn in the next 40 years of wandering in the wilderness together. This is what they learn, that the good thing is to trust God and to trust neighbor. As a matter of fact, Jesus himself, when they ask him what the greatest commandment is, says, love God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. It's a summary of what happens in the rest of the Old Testament, in the rest of those 40 years when they're wandering in the desert. Love God with all your soul, mind, strength, and heart, and love your neighbor as yourself. That's the key inoculation against idolatry. Amen.